It's hard for me to believe that it was 1995 that I began the process for becoming a United Church minister. So that's 30 years ago almost. The formal process in the United Church, at least in those days, was that your home church would make a formal recommendation on your behalf to the regional church, which in those days was called presbytery. And the presbytery would set up what's called a discernment committee. And in my case, this committee consisted of two representatives from my home church, which was West Plains United Church in Burlington, and a representative of the presbytery or of the regional church, whose first name was Murray. I don't remember his last name anymore. It's too long ago, right? But I remember his first name. And the five of us made up my discernment committee to see whether I was truly called to the ministry of the church. In my discernment committee, we spent a year investigating various aspects of ministry and church life. In one in-depth conversation, I remember us having, the five of us, about the feeding of the 5,000. I remember us talking intensely about this story. And there are lots of miracle stories in the Gospels, for sure. Can hardly turn a page without having a miracle story being shared with you in the writings. But there are only two miracle stories that are found in all four Gospels. And the one miracle story is obviously the resurrection of Jesus. But the second story that's shared in all four Gospels is the feeding of the 5,000. And that means that the feeding of the 5,000 is a very important story in the life of Jesus. And when you read the four accounts, it's interesting that none of them explain how the multiplication of the loaves and fishes took place. They're kind of vague about the process or the mechanism of multiplication. Murray's explanation for what happened that day was that Jesus gave thanks in front of the crowd. He took the bread and fish and he gave God thanks, and this inspired people in the crowd to share their food they brought with them with each other. The food that they had been hoarding for their own use was now inspired to be shared with their neighbor. And Murray suggested that it was this euphoric moment of sharing that allowed everyone to have what they needed. People took out their hidden food and they shared it with their neighbor. But I think if you take a careful and fair reading of the accounts of the feeding stories in all four Gospels, that we are dealing with something more like a miracle. There's a supernatural or supernormal element to the story. We're dealing with something more like a miracle than a natural event. We're dealing with an intervention of God in the events of that day. There's nothing in the story that would lead one to believe that a natural process was the source of this event. In fact, in the feeding of the 5,000, as told in the Gospel of John, people were so amazed with what they had experienced, what they had seen right before them. They were so blown away by it that they tried to forcibly take Jesus and make him a king. And that would not have come about, in my estimation, if Jesus had simply inspired people to be generous with each other. People were responding to a God intervention. Now, I wasn't really convinced at the time by Murray's explanation. It seemed to me that he was sidestepping the essential point of the story, trying to explain the inexplicable by reducing the miraculous event to something that we can grasp and understand. And I think the gospel writers as a group understood that we are dealing with the inexplicable in the story. And in fact, they don't try to explain the mechanism of multiplication. And I think that makes their testimony to me to seem even more reliable than it otherwise would be. They were reporting what they knew. How did Jesus go about multiplying the loaves and fishes? Well, he took them and he offered them up to God. Beyond that, the gospel writers say nothing. Presumably because they didn't know how it worked. It just worked. Do we need to know the mechanism in order to believe? Do we need to know the process as it's worked out in its specifics, as we understand and dissect it in order to believe? Do you need that in order to believe? Do you need to know the mechanism? For me, once we grant the reality of God, the idea of a miracle doesn't seem so far out of reach. What about you? That's actually one of the issues gets talked about in Alpha. If you want to explore that more, it's a great place to do that. Can God heal people? Well, if God exists, absolutely. Can God feed a multitude? If God exists, absolutely. Can God bring someone back from the dead? Well, if God exists, why not? I don't think miracles are the problem. It really comes down to whether you believe in God or not. Do you believe that there's a mind behind the universe? A creator who was the first cause of all things. A God who's still active in his creation. If you believe that God exists, is real, and is active, then the notion of miracles should be part of your active belief system, or at least you should be open to it. It's not that we don't have questions. Of course we do. It's not that we understand the mechanisms of miracles. Of course we don't. They always surprise. If someone only believes in natural causes and effects, only in mechanisms that we can explain as human beings, then I can't see how this person could ever really take miracles seriously. See, it comes down to your worldview in the end. And I think Murray was one of those people who only believed in natural causes and effects, even though he was a churchgoer and a person of faith. He didn't seem to think that what the gospel writers were laying out could be taken at face value, because he didn't believe in the possibility of mechanisms outside the natural world operating in life. And that meant he had to explain miraculous events in the natural causes and effects that he believed in. And this is an important question for Christianity, because the essential claim that it makes to the world rests on a miracle. And if you're going to demote the feeding of the 5,000 to natural causes and effects, then what about the resurrection of Jesus? What do you do with that story and that claim? What do we do with that miracle? Does it also get demoted too? Some people object to miracles based on the claim that miracles violate the laws of nature. The philosopher David Hume made that argument long ago. How can we believe, he argued, in actions that run against the basic rules, the basic laws of how nature works? And miracles obviously violate natural laws. That seems like a weak argument to me. Well, I had a little prop here, but it seems to have disappeared. Some people are too fastidious at keeping things tidy. Well, I'll use this for you. And forgive the Lord's bread, okay? So, I believe in gravity. Do you? Do you believe in gravity? I think gravity is a real thing. I experience its reality every day when I get out of bed, when I climb a hill. If I let go of this piece of bread, what will happen? If I let go of the bread again, what happens? If I let go of the bread 1,000 times in a row, what's going to happen 1,000 times in a row? It's going to fall. There seems to be no exception to the rule of gravity. I've not come across one, in this world at least, have you? But if I let go of the bread and catch it with my other hand, have I defied the law of gravity? What do you think? Have I violated the laws of nature by catching the bread in my other hand? If I were to draw my hand from this, it would fall to the ground and gravity would have its effect. It's only because I've introduced another force, my hand, that interrupts the effects of gravity. That's the only reason why the piece of bread doesn't continue on its journey to the floor. Dead bodies stay dead. We all know that. They knew that even better in the ancient world, because they didn't hide their dead bodies in hospitals and funeral homes. They dealt with them right in front of their experiences, right in the midst of their lives. They knew better than anyone that dead bodies stay dead. Dead bodies stay dead, all things being equal, like balls fall to the ground. But what happens when a force intervenes, however, in the process of death? Like paddles that come across the chest of a dead person to restart a heart. Does applying the paddles defy the law, the truth, that dead bodies stay dead? Of course not. What if God, the creator of the universe, intervenes in the reality of death for someone? What happens then? If you grant the reality of God, then it seems to me to be quite reasonable to suppose that the God who has the power to initiate life has the power to recreate it, has the power to take a dead body and make it alive again. We don't understand the mechanism of how God does this. I don't know how God does it, and I suspect you don't know how God does it either, but can it be done? If God exists, why not? In the Gospel of John, when Jesus comes to a well and engages in a conversation with a Samaritan woman, he offers her the gift of living water, and she scoffs at him because she can see that he doesn't have a bucket to draw the water up from the well. Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Translation: she doesn't understand the mechanism by which Jesus is going to bless her. There is no bucket. And that means whatever he is offering her is beyond his capacity to deliver. And this is a common approach people take with God. We often take this approach with God. We don't understand the mechanisms of God and how God does things and how God works. We think that because we can't see a bucket lying about, that therefore the Lord is incapable of blessing us, or blessing a situation of concern for us, or using us as a blessing. We limit the Holy One of Israel on the basis of the mechanisms of the natural world. We understand how a defibrillator paddle works because human beings invented this mechanism, and we trust it for this reason. But the defibrillator only works up for a couple of minutes. It only works up to a point. If a person can't be revived in a couple of minutes, it's over for them. What happens when someone is dead, not for a few minutes, but for a day or two? What happens then? All things being equal, they stay dead. But what happens when things aren't equal? What happens then? We don't know of any process that can bring someone back from the dead, at least someone who's been dead a day or two. And because we don't know of any mechanism to bring that person back from the dead, it's pretty obvious to us that God can't do that particular situation either, can't do that particular thing either. It's simply too much to believe for many. But of course, it should be the very limits of God's power that we ought to believe in. It should be what God can do beyond our understanding that is of greatest interest to us. And I think this is why the feeding of the 5,000 is found in all four Gospels. Jesus was engaged in critical teaching and training of his disciples. And the first point of this experience, this feeding of the 5,000, the first point of this event is to call our attention to this simple truth, that we are not to judge our problems exclusively in light of our available resources. Disciples stand before a huge throng of people, thousands and thousands of people. You've heard the story. You just heard it, actually. They're in a desolate place, and the disciples come to Jesus at the end of the day, and they demand that he send the crowd away to find their food needs and to satisfy their lodging for the evening. But Jesus commands his disciples to feed this throng of people. You feed them, he says. But the disciples say back to Jesus that we only have 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Which in the circumstances they're facing is essentially nothing. The disciples judged their capacity to respond to Jesus' command on the basis of their own resources. They know about the mechanism of proportionality. They know how it works. Big problems need big solutions. Their solution to the problem of feeding of the 5,000 is only 5 loaves and 2 fishes. It's way, way too small. But of course, the one thing they haven't taken into account is the reality of God. They didn't put God into their calculations. All things being equal, there's no way that 5 loaves and 2 fishes can feed thousands. Fair enough. We understand that. But then, of course, they forgot about who it was who was standing before them, who it was whose name they, that person had come before them with. All things were not equal in this scenario because the Son of God is with them. And don't we do that all the time in our own lives? We have a problem, and we understand the mechanisms of proportionality, and we don't have the resources to deal with this problem. We draw the conclusion, therefore, that it can't be dealt with, but this calculation completely ignores the reality of God. Where is God in our thinking? Remember, we are not to judge our problems exclusively in light of our available resources. And that leads us to the second important lesson in the feeding of the 5,000. Facing a problem beyond our resources and knowing how the mechanism of proportionality works, that the solution has to be at least equal to the problem, rather than determining that it can't be done because of this, we are called to put ourselves in a position for God to do something big through us. That's exactly what Jesus does. He takes 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and in a somewhat naked and vulnerable way, he looks up to heaven with them. He gazes to heaven. And in that moment, he has given the problem over to God. The blessing of Jesus offering the loaves and fish is to give them to God. That is, he transfers the loaves and fishes into God's realm now. What's going to happen from this moment forward, whatever it is, whatever mechanism is at work in this moment, is now a divine mechanism. It's not a natural mechanism that's going to take its effect in the bread and the loaves. Jesus says in Luke 12:31, and when he's talking about human need and human problems, he says, in the face of the mechanisms of proportionality that tells us big problems require big solutions, he says, this is what we are to do. Seek the kingdom of God above all else, and God will give you everything you need. Seek the kingdom of God above all else, and God will give you everything you need. It's a kind of scary thing to do when you think about it, to seek God's kingdom in the face of big problems, to hand over something to God, to trust God's way of doing things, the mysterious ways of God, because they work by different mechanisms and the natural mechanisms that we're all comfortable and familiar with, the mechanisms of the world that we live with. It's really hard to give our circumstances over to God whose mechanisms we don't understand. As they say, the mechanisms of this world we do understand, but God's not so much. What happens if it doesn't work? What happens if we give it over to God and God fails our prayers? What if God's power falters? No wonder we flinch back in those moments. No wonder we pull our hands back, our open hands back. Who wants to expose empty hands for the world to see? But the call is for us to put ourselves in a position for God to do something big through us. And that gets us to the last important lesson for today from the feeding of the 5,000. The problem of our lives are places of invitation to participate in the workings of God, to participate in the workings of God's ways. Our problems come to us so that we can know and trust and participate in the mechanisms of the kingdom. To seek the kingdom of God is more than knowing and trusting in God's holy mechanisms. It's to evaluate the problems of life from God's point of view, not our own, and then participate in God's solution for them, by allowing his will to unfold in us and through us. Now, of course, if we never put ourselves in a position for God to do something big, it will never happen. God's mechanisms only work when we keep our hands and our hearts open. We have to participate in God's solution when we shut our hands and we shut our hearts. We are tacitly committing ourselves to the natural mechanisms of this world and not the one above. Accept God's invitation in the circumstances of your life. Resist the temptation to evaluate them by the standards of the world. Instead, join Jesus in offering your circumstances to God. Participate in God's solution by handing over your problems to God and resist the temptation to take them back in the first moment of pressure when it comes to you. It's when we give the problems and challenges of life to God that we get to see God's holy mechanisms of heaven at work. And we get to participate in God's solution for them. So I got it up on a slide here. Remember, don't judge your problems in light of your own available resources. To put yourself in a position for God to do something big. And three, accept God's invitation to participate. If you do this, something amazing is going to happen. The same miraculous power that fed thousands through five loaves and two fishes, the same miraculous power that healed a blind man out by the town limits of Bethsaida, the same miraculous power that raised Jesus from the dead, that same miraculous power will be alive and at work in you.